When you find yourself completely lost, like just totally turned around in the physical world, your immediate overriding instinct is always to seek out light.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's biological.
Right. You flip a switch or you strike a match or, you frantically turn on your phone's flashlight.
Because we want illumination. Illumination brings clarity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We basically equate seeing with understanding. But what if the only way to find your bearings, like the only way to actually read the map that gets you out of the woods, is to completely plunge yourself into absolute pitch black darkness?
Which forces this complete inversion of everything we're biologically wired to do, right?
Yeah,
I
totally.
mean, we are hardwired by millions of years of evolution to associate darkness with danger because, well, predators hide in the dark.
Right, and light equals safety. It equals community.
Exactly. But occasionally, you encounter a narrative or mythology that just demands you abandon that primal instinct entirely.
It's asking a lot of you.
It really is. It asks you to trust that the physical sensory input you rely on is actually the very thing blinding you to the truth of your situation.
Which is just a wild concept. And welcome to the deep dive, by the way. Today we're looking at an ancient unnamed text, an excerpt of apocalyptic literature we've been analyzing.
And it weaponizes that exact paradox you just mentioned.
It really does. We're unpacking this short but incredibly dense, just action-packed narrative sequence today.
It's a fascinating blend, honestly. It mixes classic subterranean adventure with this intense, really high-stakes spiritual warfare.
Yeah, so we're looking at a journey that starts in this claustrophobic, trap-filled cave, and then it escalates all the way to a mountaintop clash of literal biblical proportions.
It scales up so fast. And our mission today is to really dissect the underlying mechanics of this space.
Right.
We want to examine the rich sensory details the author uses, the constant and honestly surprising duality of light and darkness, and the fascinating rules of how faith and physical actions intertwine in this universe.
Because we aren't just going to tell you what happens.
Right.
We're going to pull apart the underlying logic of how this entire world operates.
Let's get right into the mechanics of the descent then.
Yeah, let's do it. So, we begin with the protagonist standing at the threshold of a cavern,
Yeah.
but they don't just walk in. The text is very specific
It's
here.
extremely specific.
It says, quote, "I knelt and prayed."
Yeah.
So it's this very specific physical action that triggers the first major event, because when they open their map, it reveals these glowing golden rune writings.
But, and this is the key, those runes only appear in pitch blackness.
Exactly. And we learn early on that this is a map specifically leading to a witch. So we have this physical posture of submission, right?
Right.
And a spiritual act of invocation.
Plus an environmental requirement of total darkness.
Just to get the GPS to turn on.
Right, exactly. And think about the physical mechanics of kneeling for a second.
Okay, yeah.
Kneeling drastically lowers your center of gravity. It limits your mobility, and crucially, it exposes your neck.
So it's super vulnerable.
Biologically, it is a terribly vulnerable position. But in the context of this text's magic system, that physical vulnerability is the required interface.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the text explicitly links the posture of physical submission and the act of spiritual invocation to the actual functioning of the map.
So it establishes right away that we are in a universe where the physical and the spiritual are not like separate parallel tracks.
No, they are enmeshed gears.
Enmeshed gears, I like that.
Yeah.
The map is a physical object, parchment or letter or whatever, but it operates entirely on spiritual thermodynamics.
That's a great way to put it.
It operates somewhat like a piece of paper written in invisible ink that only reacts to a black light.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Right, like if you just hold invisible ink up to the regular sun, you see absolutely nothing.
You need a specific frequency of light to reveal the hidden information.
Yeah, and in this case, the quote-unquote black light is the act of prayer itself.
Exactly. Without the prayer, the map is just blank parchment.
But then there's the environmental requirement of pitch blackness. And I mean, I understand needing a specific tool to read the map, but why demand the complete absence of natural light?
Well, if we look at the broader history of mythological traditions and ascetic practices, darkness is frequently the space of the unknown,
Right.
or the unconscious, or the purely spiritual realm. I mean, think of sensory deprivation tanks today.
Oh, yeah, where you just float in the dark.
Right. The concept there is that your brain is so overwhelmed processing the physical world, like sight, sound, temperature, that it literally can't hear the internal subtle signals.
It makes a lot of sense.
So the fact that the golden runes require pitch blackness to be visible, It suggests a profound structural rule of this universe.
Which is?
That spiritual guidance only becomes clear when your natural physical sight is entirely obscured.
Wow. So you have to be intentionally blinded to the physical world to perceive the spiritual path.
Precisely. The golden glow of the runes represents a divine or magical light that simply cannot compete with natural light. It exists on a totally different frequency.
Okay, so I follow the logic of operating on a different frequency. But this brings up a logistical contradiction in the text that I really struggle to reconcile.
Let's hear it.
So the protagonist prays, right? And the pitch blackness allows the golden runes to show the path to the witch.
Yes.
But immediately after reading this map, the text states, quote, I lit a torch and stepped into the jaws of darkness.
Yeah, it does say that.
So if the map physically requires pitch blackness to display the golden runes, why does the protagonist immediately strike a torch?
This seems counterintuitive.
Yeah. By bringing physical fire into these jaws of darkness, aren't they instantly erasing the spiritual map they just activated?
Well, see, that isn't a contradiction. It's actually a deliberate illustration of the navigation paradox in this dual universe.
A navigation paradox.
Yeah, you've hit on the exact tension the author wants you to feel. The protagonist needs the absolute darkness to consult the map, right?
Right, to get the macro view of the terrain.
You should get the spiritual direction, but yeah, to actually traverse the physical terrain, to, you know, avoid tripping over a stalagmite or falling into a pit.
They need the physical localized light of the torch.
Exactly. It dictates a very specific, incredibly dangerous rhythm to their journey.
Oh, I see.
They have to stop, extinguish the physical light, seek spiritual guidance in the vulnerable dark, memorize the path, and then relight the physical fire to actually walk the dangerous earth.
Oh, wow. That means they cannot look at the map while they are walking.
Precisely. They have to rely on the fragile memory of the spiritual revelation while actively navigating immediate physical hazards.
That is so stressful. They're constantly forced to choose between seeing the big picture and seeing the very next step.
It's brilliant narrative design.
And those next steps are severe. The text describes the protagonist stepping into the jaws of darkness and then having to cross an underground river in a deep chasm.
Yeah.
We're moving from a dark, passive cave into an environment that feels, I don't know, actively hostile.
Well, the geography here operates as a psychological filter just as much as a physical barrier.
How do you mean?
Personifying the cave as the jaws of darkness, it frames the environment as a predatory entity.
Right, jaws. Like it's going to eat you.
Exactly. The cave isn't just a space, it's attempting to consume the protagonist. Furthermore, the underground river and the deep chasm function as classic mythological thresholds.
Oh, like crossing into the underworld.
Yes. If you look at the river Styx in Greek mythology or the Sanzu River in Japanese Buddhist tradition, bodies of water in subterranean spaces always represent a point of no return.
They act as a membrane between realities. You know, you can't just casually stroll into a spiritual battleground.
You really can't.
You have to cross a boundary that completely severs your tie to the normal waking world.
The chasm and the river signify that the protagonist is leaving the realm of the ordinary. They're descending into an underworld space where the standard laws of physics and biology might just no longer apply.
They are intentionally cutting off their own retreat.
Absolutely.
Which really makes the next environment they step into incredibly jarring. Because once they cross that chasm, they aren't in a natural cavern anymore.
No, everything changes.
We move from the chaotic, natural dangers of a rushing river and a bottomless pit to something intensely constructed.
From natural peril to intentional, lethal architecture.
Exactly. So after the chasm, the protagonist arrives at a temple. But this temple is filled with coffins that are physically bolted or built into the walls.
The psychological shift there is immense. I mean, think about it. A cavern is dangerous because it is indifferent to you.
Right. A stalactite falls because of gravity and erosion, not malice.
Exactly. But a temple is an intentional space built by intelligence. And when that intelligence decides to incorporate coffins directly into the load-bearing walls of the architecture,
it creates an immediate sense of dread.
It absolutely does. It signals to the protagonist and to you, the reader, that death is not just a byproduct of this space.
Death is the foundational aesthetic.
Yes.
So the protagonist is carrying a ring at this point that begins pulsing with green light.
Right, the green ring.
And the text doesn't explicitly spell out the origin of this ring yet, but it acts as an environmental meter reacting to the space.
Sort of like a Geiger counter for magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then the protagonist performs an action that seems almost careless, but triggers a massive escalation.
This part is wild.
They pick up a stone and throw it at a beam of sunlight that is hitting the temple wall.
Yeah.
And the instant the physical stone breaks the beam of sunlight, a trap is triggered. One of the wall-mounted coffins activates, swings open, and literally begins firing skeleton bats and poison darts into the room.
The mechanics of this trap are wonderfully subversive. Let's look at how light is traditionally utilized in these narratives.
Usually it's a good thing.
Exactly. Usually, if you are lost deep underground and you see a shaft of sunlight filtering down from a crack in the ceiling, that sunlight is a symbol of hope.
Yeah, it's a guide. It shows you the way out, or it illuminates something pure.
But the author of this text completely subverts that deeply ingrained expectation. Here, sunlight is the literal tripwire for an ancient defense mechanism.
I understand the subversion, but let me push back on that interpretation just a little bit.
Sure. Go ahead.
Isn't the sun also historically tied to the concept of harsh justice, like a burning away impurity?
Oh, certainly.
Think of Apollo or the concept of things being bleached and sterilized by the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Could it be that the sunlight isn't just a subverted symbol of hope, but is actually acting as a purifier?
That's interesting.
And the protagonist, by throwing a rock and casting a shadow, is introducing a flaw into that pure beam, which is what triggers the defense.
I mean, that's a strong counter-reading, but I'd argue the architecture points more toward weaponization than purification.
Why is that?
Well, the fact that the beam is connected to a mechanical coffin implies engineering. Whoever built this temple captured a natural element, the sun, and integrated it into a circuit.
Oh, like an optical sensor.
Exactly. They took the ultimate source of life and turned it into a trigger for death. And the specific imagery of the threat is really telling here.
The skeleton bats and poison darts.
Right. This isn't just a boulder rolling down a hallway.
No, it's incredibly precise. If I'm picturing a skeleton bat, I'm picturing a grim fusion of necromancy and mechanical engineering.
Oh.
It's like a, well, like a macabre drone.
Macabre drone, exactly. It implies an intelligence that is both deeply magical, animating dead tissue and bone, and highly systematic, building automated turrets out of them.
It's terrifying.
It shows the protagonist is dealing with an enemy who is organized, technologically advanced within their magic system, and deeply sadistic.
It's essentially a supernatural photoelectric sensor breaking a circuit. Just a terrifying fusion of ancient magic and mechanical logic.
So true.
So how do you disarm a trap that uses sunlight as a laser grid and shoots undead shrapnel?
Very carefully.
Yeah, right. The text gives us a very specific multi-step puzzle solution. The protagonist takes the pulsing green light from their ring, specifically the illuminated runes from it, and places them onto their map.
But just placing them isn't enough.
You know, they have to read the runes aloud. And upon vocalizing them, a moon-shaped mark etched into the floor magically transforms into a star.
The sequence of actions required to solve this puzzle is crucial to understanding the physics of this magic system.
Okay, unpack that for us.
It requires a synthesis of components. You have the map, which we established acts as a spiritual interface.
Right.
You have the light from the ring, which represents a personal, localized energy. But crucially, you have the voice.
The vocalization.
Yes. Reading the runes aloud emphasizes the mechanism of vocal actualization. In many ancient esoteric traditions, you know, a thought or an intention has no mass in the physical world until it is spoken.
Because sound waves are a physical manipulation of the air.
Precisely. By speaking the runes, the protagonist is converting spiritual intention into kinetic reality.
Wow. And that kinetic reality manifests as the moon mark physically shifting its shape to become a star.
Mm.
I really want to drill down into the thermodynamics of that symbol change, though.
It's a great detail.
Why a moon to a star?
Consider the fundamental astronomical difference between those two celestial bodies.
Okay.
A Froon is a barren rock. It merely reflects light from another source. It is entirely passive.
Right. It doesn't make its own light.
But a star, however, is a nuclear furnace. It generates its own light through internal fusion. It is intensely active.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
The puzzle is a mechanical metaphor for the protagonist's required psychological shift. To survive this temple, they cannot be a moon. They cannot rely solely on passive reflection or external guidance.
They have to become a star.
Exactly. They must generate their own active internal power.
And that structural logic pays off immediately. The moment the star completes its transformation on the floor, a massive coffin descends from the ceiling on heavy chains.
Landing dead center on the star.
Yes. And carved into the lid of this coffin is the figure of a knight. Right next to the night is a phrase carved in Latin.
The text thankfully translates it for us.
Yes, it reads, quote, "The key of the star eye's glow illuminates the universe beyond."
That Latin phrase essentially acts as the Rosetta Stone for the entire room. Let's break down the phrasing. The key of the star eye's glow.
Well, we just discussed the star representing generated active light.
Exactly. And the concept of the star eye implies a specific kind of vision. A gaze that doesn't just passively receive light, but actively projects illumination from within.
The protagonist realizes the literal application of this poetry right away. They take their ring, which is pulsing with that green light, and they place it directly into the eye socket of the carved knight on the coffin.
Because the eye is quite literally a keyhole.
Yeah. The ring fits, there's an audible mechanical click, and the heavy coffin unlocks itself.
Look at how the text bridges the abstract and the mechanical here. Placing the ring into the knight's lock perfectly physicalizes the metaphor of the Latin text.
To illuminate the universe beyond.
Which, in this immediate context, means unlocking the coffin to see the hidden danger or truth inside. You must insert your own inner spiritual light into the rigid ancient structure.
That click of the lock is the sound of the metaphysical aligning with the physical.
Beautifully said.
Once that click happens, the entire scale and atmosphere of the narrative violently contracts.
It really does.
We transition from grand architectural danger, dodging sunlight tripwires, dealing with room-sized puzzles, and giant descending chained coffins to something unbelievably intimate.
We shift from external engineered threats to a claustrophobic, deeply personal confrontation.
The author essentially pulls the camera from a wide-angle lens to an extreme macro shot.
A perfect way to visualize it.
Inside the coffin is a woman. Her name is Elisa. And the text describes her with intense sensory focus. She is dressed entirely in black, and her face is covered by a veil.
And the detail that grounds the scene in reality is that the veil is gently swaying to the rhythm of her breath.
Yeah. She isn't a corpse. She's alive in there.
That specific sensory detail, the rhythmic swaying of a thin fabric, it creates a masterful contrast.
It really is a stark difference.
Just moments ago, the environment was defined by grinding iron chains, the rush of poison darts, and the clattering of skeleton bats.
Loud metallic chaos.
Right. To transition from that to the silent organic movement of a breathing veil draws both the protagonist and the listener into a false sense of quiet intimacy.
A completely false sense.
Yeah.
Because the protagonist reaches out and moves the veil. And the first thing they see is a physical blemish, a witch's mark on her chin.
But before they can even process that,
Elisa's eyes snap open. The text specifically notes that her eyes are, quote, entirely pitch black. And without a word, she hisses, lunges upward out of the coffin, and violently grabs the protagonist by the throat.
It's so abrupt. And the visual of the pitch black eyes is a critical thematic callback. Remember how the journey started?
The cave itself was pitch black.
Exactly. A darkness so absolute it was required to read the map. By giving Elisa pitch black eyes, the narrative is diagnosing her condition.
She hasn't just been placed in the dark environment.
No, the dark environment has colonized her biology. The malice of the subterranean space has infiltrated her completely. She is functioning as a biological extension of the temple's traps.
It's a terrifying escalation because it completely invalidates the protagonist's toolkit.
It really does.
If you think about the mechanics of a fight, the protagonist has a torch, a map, a glowing ring, and they just outsmarted a complex architectural puzzle.
But none of those tools mean anything when an adversary has a physical crushing grip on your windpipe.
It's like bringing a sword to a ghost fight.
Exactly. You can't burn a curse with a torch, and you can't decode a chokehold. The physical laws of combat fail here. A totally different mechanism of defense is required.
You're highlighting the core tension of asphyxiation and narrative here. When your windpipe is crushed, your primary biological function, breathing, is halted.
Your physical autonomy is stripped away.
Yeah, panic is the biological default. But panic requires oxygen, and fighting back requires physical leverage.
When both are denied, the protagonist has no choice but to retreat inward. The physical avenues are blocked off, so they must use a spiritual avenue.
Which they do. The text states that the protagonist prays, quote, "in my heart." They are physically incapable of speaking the runes aloud like they did with the puzzle.
Right, they are forced into silent internal communication.
And the cry they make in their heart is, quote, "deliver us from evil."
Now, pay very close attention to the pronoun used in that internal invocation. Deliver us from evil.
Us.
Not me.
Not deliver me. I see what you're saying. If someone is currently actively strangling you, The biological imperative is self-preservation. You're thinking, get her off me.
Precisely. But the protagonist, even through the panic of oxygen deprivation, correctly diagnoses the nature of the threat.
They recognize that Elisa isn't the real enemy here.
Right. She is not the true architect of the violence. She is a captive weapon of the environment. The prayer is structurally intercessory.
It's aimed at saving the attacker alongside the victim.
It requires a massive amount of empathy to pray for the deliverance of the person currently murdering you.
That's profound. And the mechanism of the universe responds to that specific empathy immediately.
It does.
The text says the protagonist feels the sudden presence of the Holy Spirit, which is described as an overwhelming sense of love. And accompanying this feeling is a voice, or perhaps a profound internal realization, that delivers a very specific axiom.
This is a great line.
It is. It says, quote, "Love is stronger than death. Deep waters cannot drown it."
The utilization of that specific phrasing is where the text's architecture truly shines. Let's look at that phrase. Deep waters cannot drown it.
Okay.
This is a direct, deliberate echo of the physical geography we discussed at the very beginning of the deep dive.
The underground river they had to cross to enter the temple.
Exactly. The protagonist had to navigate the physical hazard of the deep waters in the cavern. Those waters represented a lethal physical boundary.
Right.
But here, the text establishes a metaphysical corollary. The curse currently afflicting Elisa, the pitch black possession, is likened to metaphysical deep waters.
That is so cool.
The logic being presented is that while physical water can drown a physical body, the metaphysical deep waters of a curse cannot drown the frequency of love.
The text creates a seamless symmetry between the geological obstacles and the spiritual obstacles.
It essentially argues that the environment is just a gross physical manifestation of the spiritual stakes.
And the resolution of this close quarters encounter happens the moment that realization clicks. As the frequency of love is introduced, Elisa's hands instantly go limp, releasing the protagonist's throat.
And the grimace of the attack softens into a smile.
Right. And her eyes undergo a physical transformation. The pitch blackness recedes, and her natural bright green eyes return, which notably perfectly color matches the green light of the protagonist's ring.
The restoration of the green eyes acts as a visual confirmation that the curse has been broken. The cave's darkness has been purged from her biology.
And the matching color.
The fact that her eye color matches the light of the protagonist's ring suggests a shared resonance. It implies a restoration of her humanity and establishes a connective circuit between the two characters.
The sequence of what happens next is fascinating, though, and I really want to break down the causality here.
Okay, let's do it.
The text explicitly orders the events. The internal prayer happens, the grip on the throat loosens, and her green eyes return.
Yes, in that order.
Then the protagonist kisses her. And it is only after that physical kiss that the text says the entire cave brightens and a host of angels suddenly appears, praising God.
Oh.
So I have to ask, what actually solved the problem? Was it the internal spiritual prayer that broke the curse? Or was it the physical human act of the kiss that sealed the deliverance and triggered the angelic manifestation?
It's a vital question of mechanics. And the text seems to argue that you simply cannot separate the two.
You need both.
It presents a system where spiritual grace and physical action are fundamentally interdependent. Let's look at the stages. The inward prayer of Deliver Us was the required countermeasure to break the immediate hostile spiritual hold of the curse.
It halted the physical violence and returned her eyes to normal.
Right. However, the text implies that the victory isn't fully locked in until that internal spiritual reality is manifested externally through physical act of connection.
So the prayer removes the negative, but the physical act introduces the positive.
You could frame it that way, yeah. The kiss acts as a physical seal on the spiritual deliverance. It proposes that divine intervention or cosmic shifts require human participation to be fully anchored in the material world.
That's beautiful.
The angels do not appear simply because a prayer was successfully executed in a vacuum. They manifest because two human beings achieve genuine connection and love in an environment designed entirely to manufacture death and isolation.
It's as if the prayer unlocked the heavy door. But the physical action actually pushed the door open to let the light flood the room.
Exactly.
When that light arrives, it fundamentally alters the scale of the narrative again. We have just spent the last few minutes analyzing an intensely claustrophobic struggle inside a single coffin.
But the consequence of saving this one person in this isolated cave immediately triggers a macro-level atmospheric reaction.
The perspective of the text just rips us out of the subterranean space.
The shift in perspective is violently abrupt. We are instantly transported from a subterranean microenvironment to the atmospheric macroenvironment of a mountaintop.
Yeah, the text states, quote, "The vision then shifted to the top of the mountain. And upon this peak, we finally see the architect of the malice."
It's the witch.
Right. The map from the beginning promised a path to a witch, and here she is. She is described as massive and hunched. She is actively screaming and casting spells down upon a village located at the base of the mountain, and she is entirely enveloped in swirling black clouds and gloom.
If we analyze the elemental composition of this new scene, the author is executing a massive thematic pivot here.
Oh, so?
Down in the cave, the threats were composed of earth, stone, and subterranean water, the realm of the buried.
Right.
Here on the mountain peak, we are thrust into the volatile elements of air and weather. We are dealing with massive black clouds, altitude, and open sky. The witch isn't just casting hexes. She is utilizing meteorological magic.
Which reframes the entire preceding sequence.
Completely.
Because it tells us that the localized, intimate struggle in the cave was actually a vital component of a regional war.
Exactly. Elisa wasn't just a random victim. Her captivity in that coffin, her curse, was somehow serving as a linchpin or a battery for the massive witch on the mountain.
Wow. So by breaking the circuit in the cave, the protagonist has destabilized the witch's power source above.
That reframes the protagonist's entire journey, doesn't it?
It really does. They thought they were just surviving a trap to save a captive. But they were actually disabling the shield generator for the main villain.
A great way to put it.
And because they succeeded in the dirt and the dark, they are granted a vision to witness the cosmic retaliation.
And it is cosmic.
The black clouds surrounding which are suddenly pierced. The sky violently splits open with lightning, and a giant glowing white angel materializes in the storm.
Notice the introduction of a new elemental force here. We've had earth, we've had air, we've had water, now we have divine fire.
Yes.
The text describes this giant white angel not with a harp or a halo, but holding a, quote, fiery iron chain.
It's an incredibly brutal, martial image of an angel.
It is. The fiery iron chain operates as a symbol of absolute, inescapable justice. Iron is rigid. It does not yield or compromise. Fire is dual-natured. It purifies, but it also consumes and punishes.
It's a huge contrast with the green light from earlier.
Yes. Contrast this blazing, terrifying light of the fiery chain with the gentle, pulsing green light of the protagonist's ring. The green light was human, personal, and restorative.
But the fiery light of the angel is overwhelming, impersonal, and destructive.
And the scale of the destruction is absolute. The angel doesn't negotiate.
No. The angel hurls the fiery chain, wrapping it securely around the massive witch. And the text notes that she burns and screams within the iron bindings.
But the angel doesn't leave her on the mountain.
No. The angel physically lifts this massive entity high into the sky, flies outward over the open sea, and drops her into a massive dark whirlpool that is opened up in the ocean.
And here we reach the architectural climax of the text's themes. We return to the element of water. Let's recall the specific voice the protagonist heard during the struggle in the coffin.
Love is stronger than death. Deep waters cannot drown it.
Right. We established that metaphysical deep waters couldn't drown the protagonist's empathy.
Exactly.
But look at the mechanism of the witch's execution. She is dropped directly into a massive dark whirlpool in the middle of the sea. The witch is literally drowned by deep waters.
Oh, wow. How didn't you put that together?
Water in this narrative acts as a flawless reactive mirror. When it interacts with love, the deep waters are entirely powerless. They cannot drown it.
Right.
But when the deep waters interact with absolute evil, they become the ultimate consuming instrument of divine justice. The exact same element that failed to destroy the protagonist is utilized to annihilate the witch.
The physics of that are brilliant.
Yeah.
It's as if the deep waters act as a spiritual specific gravity test.
Yes, a specific gravity test.
If you are operating on the frequency of love, you are buoyant. You float. But if you are operating on the density of malice and evil, you are pulled under.
And the witch is definitively pulled under.
The text concludes this sequence by describing the screaming witch being sucked down through the whirlpool into the depths of the earth, descending all the way to hell and the abyss. It is a complete systemic eradication of the threat.
It really is.
But from a purely logistical standpoint, I mean, how is the listener supposed to interpret the reality of this final scene?
What do you mean?
The text transitions by stating, The vision then shifted to the top of the mountain. Does the underlying logic of the universe imply this mountain battle is happening in real time?
Okay, I see.
Is the protagonist physically standing in the now illuminated subterranean cave, holding Elisa, and merely watching this event play out as a hallucination in their mind's eye?
Yeah.
Or has their consciousness been forcibly ejected from their body and pulled up to the mountain peak to act as a physical witness?
Well, the use of the term vision in the context of apocalyptic and esoteric literature is highly specific, and it's often intentionally layered.
Okay.
A vision in this genre is rarely just a hallucination. It is typically an overlay of a higher spiritual reality onto limited physical sight.
So they're seeing something real, just not with their physical retinas.
Precisely. It is highly probable that the protagonist's physical body remains grounded in the cave, perhaps even momentarily blinded by the sudden, localized brightness of the angels that appeared after the kiss.
Right.
However, their spiritual sight, the faculty that was initially activated back in the pitch-black cavern when they read the golden runes,
is now fully, permanently dilated.
Yes. They are receiving a real-time spiritual broadcast of the macro-level victory that their micro-level earthly action catalyzed. They are witnessing the cosmic chain reaction.
It provides an incredible sense of closure to the narrative. You don't just walk away knowing you survived a trap and saved one person. You are explicitly shown how your isolated, desperate actions in the dark recalibrated the scales of the entire region.
It's incredibly satisfying storytelling.
We've unpacked a massive amount of conceptual ground today. It's genuinely remarkable how this brief excerpt structurally guides you from a micro-level puzzle, you know, kneeling in pitch blackness to read a Mac, dodging sunlight sensors and mechanical skeleton bats, all the way up to a macro-level atmospheric war involving giant angels, fiery chains, and oceanic whirlpools.
The escalation of stakes is meticulously engineered.
It really is. The narrative architecture is as intricate and lethal as the Temple of Coffins we analyzed.
But as we synthesize all of this, I want to leave you with a final analytical lens to apply to the text.
Go for it.
We have spent the last while discussing massive, overwhelming elemental extremes. The blinding golden runes, the pitch black eyes of the curse, the blazing white of the angel, the fiery iron chain, the black clouds.
Yeah, lots of very extreme imagery.
But I want you to consider the specific, quiet utilization of the color green throughout the text.
The protagonist's ring and Elisa's eyes.
Exactly. The ring, which served as the key to unlocking the central puzzle, pulsed with a localized green light. And when the pitch black curse was broken, Elisa's true nature was revealed to be bright green eyes.
It's true.
In a narrative landscape utterly dominated by the uncompromising, violent extremes of black and white, dark and light, fire and abyss, the color green acts as a vital, organic, connective tissue.
It's the only color that feels alive.
It is. It suggests a profound philosophical stance by the author. While cosmic forces, like angels and witches, divine justice and ancient malice, battle in the stark, destructive absolutes of black and white, human reality does not operate there.
We're caught in the middle.
Right. Human salvation, empathy, and connection exist in the complex, vibrant, living frequency of green. It represents growth, earth, and the stubborn persistence of humanity amidst a war of cosmic extremes.
The heavens might fight in fire and lightning, but we survive the green.
Beautifully said.
If you are listening to this and wondering how to apply the physics of an ancient, magical subterranean cavern to your own reality, think back to the very first paradox we discussed. The map only worked in the dark.
Right.
Sometimes, the constant blinding illumination of our modern lives, the endless streams of data, the glowing screens, the constant noise acts, exactly like that sunlight trap in the temple.
Oh, absolutely.
It triggers anxiety, it overwhelms our circuits, and it prevents us from seeing the more subtle internal directions we actually need to follow.
It drowns out the signal.
Consider what it might look like to intentionally step into the dark, to turn off the physical light, remove the sensory inputs, and allow your own internal vision to adjust to a different frequency. You might find that the quote-unquote runes you need to navigate your own complexities have been there the whole time. They were just drowned out by the light.
That's a great thought to leave on.
Until next time, keep analyzing the underlying mechanics of the stories around you. Keep questioning the obvious inputs, and thank you for taking the deep dive with us.